This is the Mike of New York podcast. I am Mike Cohen. We are with Edwin Duterte, a Filipino-American leader on the west coast of the United States. Edwin is famous for taking on Mad Maxine Waters and others in California politics. But what a lot of people don't know here on the East Coast and many other parts of the world is that Edwin is well-versed when it comes to investments, when it comes to real estate, when it comes to the general picture socioeconomically between the United States, the Philippines, and of course, Japan. Because after all, one of the largest investment zones for Japanese in the United States is in his area, which is the greater Los Angeles area. Let's have Edwin give us a greeting. Hey, Edwin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Mike, and thanks for having me on your show. I guess today had some really big news in regards to the Philippines, United States, and Japan. So it's been a very active day, and looking forward to talking about what went on today.
You know, the interesting thing for us is both in our families, yours, of course, Duterte's in the Philippines, are well known for having been active as guerrillas fighting in World War II on the side of the Philippine government, on the side of the United States, very active supporting the rebellion that was being held by Filipinos who wouldn't surrender on this date period, this period right now, because this was during the time, 82 years ago today, was the start of the Bataan Death March, just a couple days ago. This is when that big defeat for the United States took place in the Philippines on the Bataan Peninsula. But for Cebu and for Davao, Zamboanga, that area where my family is from, they kept on fighting. They kept on trying. They resisted until the Japanese forced them up into the hills. So how does that feel to you? What is your family history? Did your dad, grandparents tell you about, that history of World War II and the people in your family who fought on the side of freedom?
You know, what's interesting is, my father was the youngest of, I think, eight children, and he was born during the war. He was only a baby. So one of the, father's family really didn't talk about the war as well. But what my father did remember from World War II, when the Japanese came into town, he remembers his sisters or his brothers picking him up, and he can remember the leaves and the grass hit his feet as they hid, in the caves and in the mountains and so forth. So, so in terms of historical, war and so forth, I don't really know too much about my family involvement because it just wasn't a topic at our kitchen table. But he does remember, things are very scary as a 2-3 year old, and the fact of the grass blades hitting his feet, is pretty interesting just to think. As a 2 and 3 year old, that's one of the things he remembers. That's the only thing he remembers.
Well, my mom and her two sisters and two brothers, they had to literally flee from Zamboanga City across a crocodile-infested bay, hiding underneath the slots of a boat, smuggled out from Zamboanga City because they were very Caucasian. And because of the fact that they're Filipinos, but they're fair-skinned, was a risk for them to just be found by the Japanese. They might be mistaken for Americans. Actually, they were, their father was a Russian refugee who settled in the Philippines, a white Russian refugee, they call them. Those who were fighting from communism, and then he settled in the Philippines somehow. And but he stayed up in the hills. He continued to fight during that period. But this time, usually for my family, April 9, 10, 11, we would usually go up to Bataan, which is where there is a massive cross. And a few days ago, the Japanese ambassador, the American ambassador, and the Philippine president spoke about these things, how things have changed and how it also holds a little bit of hope for the situation with China, I guess, because you know how bad as things were back then, we were killing each other. It took an atomic bomb to defeat Japan. I mean, it was bad. It was war. You know, it was the worst war in human history. But even with all that, look at it now. I mean, Japan is America's closest Pacific ally when it comes to strength, when it comes to technology, when it comes to even keeping its economy alive in many areas. Who is saving America's steel industry? It's the Japanese, although not everybody's happy about that. But when you think about it, you know, things could change with China. At that time, China was our ally. China was when we were on the side of it. So when we talk about these things, we talk about security and everything, you know, I'd just like our listeners to know that, you know, we're not saying that, hey, forever, it's going to be a battle between Chinese, Filipinos, Japanese, and Americans. No, it just happens to be that at this time, there's tension between the countries. China wants to take over the South China Sea and take all the reefs and islands out there. My family is from Palawan Island in the Philippines and very close to there. So for us, that is the situation. Your family is mostly here in the West Coast, although you do have relatives, some very famous ones, who are all over the Philippines as well. What do you view this at from a people-to-people type thing? Where do you see this for Filipino-Americans, particularly there on the West Coast, where you do have a very large Japanese-American population? We don't have such a huge Japanese-American population in New York, for example. But you have a very large Japan town, very large Korea town. What is the difference there for you compared to what we see here, perhaps, on an East Coast that is mostly probably large Chinatowns or large Chinese American communities?
Right. Well, I live in Redondo Beach, and what's interesting is, you know, in the surrounding areas like Torrance and Gardena, there's a huge, you know, Japanese American population. You know, 15 miles, up near downtown LA, we have, you know, Koreatown, and you know, even to that matter, Torrance is there's a big Korean base. Demographic and community. So, and of course, we do have a large Chinese. So, you know, Southern California has a very strong melting pot of the various Asian communities. And what's really interesting is, you know, just, you know, 60, 70 years ago, you know, with the Philippines and the United States at war with Japan, now today, you know, we have that trilateral with Japan, Philippines, and in the United States, to discuss the economic as well as defensive things that they can do, to counter, you know, a China stronghold in the Pacific, you know, in terms of economics, in terms of you know, territory, and how the Chinese, you know, seemingly to being harassing the Filipino fishermen and so forth. And you know, I think a lot of countries that border China are all having you know, boundary issues with China. You know, like you know, India, you know, China, you know, Korea, Japan. It seems like all of them have an issue with China. So I think today is just one of those days where we have to reflect of, you know, historically we can be enemies one century and the next allies, and try to make each other's country stronger, whether that's economic or militarily.
Yeah, and let's face it, you know, before I called you for this get together that we're having on my podcast, I was eating Chinese food, I have to admit it, but they did have, at this Chinese restaurant, which was serving Chinese food, they did have Japanese sushi rolls. I don't know if it was the wisest thing for me to do, but I did have some Japanese sushi, I had some Chinese food, and obviously I come home and, you know, there's some Filipino chicharron, which is sitting there. So I had all of it, and I kind of look American. I mean, we all look American. Everybody, there really is no American look, but you know what I'm saying? Kind of look Caucasian. So, you know, I probably look like a Death March person, although I could use probably half the Death March in terms of, you know, losing weight, but maybe not the whole death thing, you know? But anyway, getting back to reality, because that sounds just so weird. What were the talking points today? You said that the State Department came out with something, or the White House came out with something. What happened today, as far as you know, at the White House?
Well, as far as I know, based on and I haven't been watching too much, media. So what I have been looking at is a fact sheet that the White House put out on their website, and basically they're talking about the strength of the U.S.-Philippine alliance, and some of the things that came out of today's meetings or some of the focuses, a lot of the inclusive economic growth of the Philippines, where they want to invest in infrastructure, where they announced the first partnership for global infrastructure and investment corridor in the Indo-Pacific, specifically in the Luzon Economic Corridor, which will support connectivity between Subic Bay, Clark, Manila, Batangas, the Philippines, and so forth. So I think that's one of the big things. And they're also going to invest, or at least leverage, I think it's like $500 million, $600 million, some large number to support their renewable energy and smart grids and so forth. And from what I understand, a lot of it is going to be small micro nuclear energy systems, that as well as a lot of the different semiconductor cooperations and the different forums that they're going to be doing in the Philippines to support the United States industry. And also they talked about doing more clean energy and also they're going to be expanding the defense and security cooperation amongst the Philippines and Japan and the United States. So I think that's pretty interesting that the fact sheet led off more on focusing on the economic development and the clean energy, which I believe, and this is just my opinion, and I'm not a DC insider at all, but in my opinion, I think a lot of the strategic things that were coming out were to support and enforce military defense should something happen in the China region.
What we're seeing is basically this, the changes, of course, in the Philippines taking place, let's say, since the time of Ferdinand Marcos Sr., the current president's father. Back then, the minimum wage for Manila was probably 90 pesos at a time when the peso to the dollar was about 45 pesos to $1 or 35 pesos to $1 in the early part of his term. But essentially, what we're seeing right now is a minimum wage in Metro Manila, for example, of about 570 pesos a day. And trust me, that's minimum. It's hard to feed a family in Manila on 500 pesos, even 10 years ago when I was working in Manila. So 500 pesos for the average daily worker, plus, let's say the 70 pesos he uses for taxes or transportation or whatever, it's still pretty tight. Well, that's about less than a little more rather than $10 a day. Yeah, $10 a day, yeah, that won't even buy you a Happy Meal in some places here in the United States, But when you think about it, that is a massive change considering over a period of time, it's gone from $2 a day wage to $10 a day wage. It's inflation also, a little less purchasing power of the dollar and all that. But it is also the intertwinedness of our U.S. economy into the Philippines. A lot of people know, especially Filipino Americans know, that you can go home to Manila. Well, not really home, for those of us who do consider it home or were born there. You can go home to the Philippines and get a call center job for a while if you really are low on income and chances here in the United States. Hey, you can always use your accent to gain some gainful employment. Tell me about it. I tried it several times. But the reality is, there is a very close intertwined economy with the BPO, KPO, business processing, outsourcing, as well as back office, accounting, services. Do you know that there are restaurants here in New York City where you order and the person taking the order is a Filipino and they are on a screen? So you have not a virtual waiter, you have a digital waiter in many restaurants in Soho and some other places here in New York City. And it has become the in thing to have a Filipino 24/7 ready to go waiter or checkout counter staff at many stores and restaurants. And this is becoming more and more common. So like if you go into Target or something, there'll be somebody who'll just say, oh, hold that higher so I can scan it and all that. And you're thinking, oh, the person's on the other side of the glass or something. No, that's a screen, you know, and they're in the Philippines. Mabuhay.
Oh, I love it. Well, you know what's interesting is, you know, something like that, you know, and I love that. We haven't experienced anything like that where you're going to a grocery store and or restaurants and, you know, participating with or interacting with a Filipino from overseas to help you out with some of the remedial, you know, lower wages types of jobs. We're not seeing that, but I love that idea. But I don't know if in this generation that how long that will be. We can take advantage of that because of AI. I think AI is taking over some of these tasks that the Filipinos have been doing, especially the international calls, call centers and so forth. I think technology is going to slowly phase that type of work away, if not in a few years, you know, maybe less than a decade, because of the AI. So I think what the investment that was announced today, in particular, the more investments into critical industries like the semiconductor industry, I think that will be you know, more of a blessing and you know, more of the Filipinos can take advantage of it because they're higher educated workers. I think they could, and they're so detailed workers that they can transition into a call center situation, into a semiconductor type of industry. So I think today's announcement and some of the agreements or the agreements that kind of look like they're there that are complementing the last year's discussions with the Philippines and the semiconductor industry. I think that could help shore up some of the possible or potential problems we're going to see with semiconductors should Taiwan have some kind of supply chain issues because of China or, you know, or an earthquake or something like that. I think the Philippines is just ripe for taking over the semiconductor and other technologies that can be floated over to the Philippines that can help out not only the American demographics or the population, but I think worldwide it could just alleviate some of the supply chain issues that could arise should Taiwan be hurt economically.
There's something ironic there in all that. It's because if you go up to Baguio City in the central part of Luzon, where it's up in the mountains, you will drive out to an area where the Philippine Military Academy is. And as you're going to the Philippine Military Academy, it's kind of the West Point of Asia. It's built and patterned after our West Point here. And as you're driving out to that facility, you will pass by one of the largest Texas Instruments chips manufacturing facilities in the world. It was actually where much of the early computer chips, not the ones now, but the early ones and processors, were made back in the day. I think it's functioning, and it's still actually owned by Texas Instruments and some subsidiaries of Taiwanese companies like Foxconn that are also there. And the reason they choose to be there is that area of the Philippines produces gold. We also have rare earth metals within that sector or that area. And they also produce the coconut-based wafer chips, I'm sorry, motherboards, that are very popular with insects in some computers. But unfortunately, yeah.
Like,
they learned how to make the motherboards out of a certain byproduct from coconut. So that's kind of interesting. So obviously we're both dads. Your son is much younger than my four boys, who are, you know, all in college and whatnot, but mine are all military age. And I would hate to see a war happen, especially when you're my age, even though one of my sons does work for DARPA and in the defense industry. And your son is busy talking right now and trying to get into the conversation. Hi, Nathan. Yeah. How are you?
He's doing good. He's looking for candy.
Ah, okay.
Yes. So it's some scary times. With both of our families, where, you know, in the next 2 years, it can really, you know, we might see something happen. You know, as the United States, you know, seems to be weaker on a global stage.
Yeah, Admiral Aquilino was saying that the commander of the Pacific Area Command, Indo-Pacific Area Command, during budget hearings about 2 weeks ago, on the 21st of March, was in the House of Representatives before the Armed Services Committee. And Admiral John Aquilino was talking about how, okay, the Navy's going to retire 19 ships this year, but we're only going to replace 6 of those ships that we're retiring. And not only that, the 10 frigates that we were supposed to be building and have ready by now, well, only one of them will be commissioned by next year. Nine are still on the building blocks. In fact, not all of the 9 are actually being built right now. And that was already funded. That was paid for during the time of President Trump. The plans for those were laid out towards the tail end of President Obama. It's not like a totally new thing that just popped up. You know, the idea is that the Navy needs to replace its ships, maintain a certain level, because according to Admiral Aquilino, they need to be able to go to what's going on right now in the Red Sea, dealing with basically the Houthi rebels who are like pirates attacking shipping. And then also deal with situations with Ukraine. You know, should there be a need to bring in humanitarian assistance, where they're able to go there. Gaza, they have to be able to deal with that situation as well. And you have all these situations around the world where the Navy is basically the world's policeman. And, well, they don't have enough cars anymore. You know, the ships are getting older. The crews don't want to work. Recruitment is a big problem. Like me, I don't want any of my four sons serving in this military right now, not because I don't like the military or anything. I spent 30 years covering the military as a journalist, and I have a lot of respect for the men and women in uniform who fight, who suffered, who died. I've been with them in foxholes. I've been with them in combat. I know what it's like. I know what they go through. So it's not a situation being against that. But the reason I wouldn't want my kids to be in there is because of how strange it is right now. They're talking more about, you know, how to deal with gender issues and all these other weird things that basically soldiers don't really need to deal with. You know, I mean, in a combat situation, nobody really cares what gender you are. They care about where the pointy end of the bullet is pointing and going to, and, you know, where to pull the trigger because the enemy might be.
Right. Well, you know, to compound that, not only are we having a very untrained, soldier, or, you know, the social justice soldier, but we're also having problems with the qualifications of the recruit. I heard testimonial last week, where, in Congress and some of the committees, as well as some of the officers, say that recruitment, they can't even, the recruiters, when they take the, or recruits, when they take the test, they can't even pass the basic ASVAB test. Their test scores are so low that that they can't pass, let alone they're lowering the standards, where before you used to at least have a high school diploma or at very least a GED. Now you don't even have to have, from my understanding, you don't even have to have a GED or equivalent. You know, not only are we having the social, cultural problems in the military, but now, now the smart guys don't even want to go, or even the normal, regular people don't want to serve, and the ones who do want to serve are not qualified to even write their name. And that's how bad our military is, and scary for both of our children.
The reality is, though, considering that Filipino Americans make up, I believe, the number five or number fourth minority in the entire United States military, whether it's the Air Force, Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, wherever you find an American ship, you will find a Filipino on board that ship. And 90% of the time, he's going to be cooking the food. You know what I mean? That's just the reality. Hey, that's Pinoy Mafia in the Navy.
Food or wrapping the Band-Aid.
Yeah. You know, they're going to be either the orderly or that. But also, a lot of the, like I just mentioned, you know, the admirals who are commanding the battleships, we don't have battleships anymore, they're museums, but the aircraft carriers are being commanded by Filipino-Americans. You know, I believe the George Washington has a Filipino-American captain, you know, who is actually almost a full bird, about to get a star admiral level. And then you have other, you know, military personnel within the United States Navy who are Filipino American. So this agreement also is very important because there may be a high probability that the U.S. Navy will open up recruitment again to Filipinos.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd rather have the U.S. military open up to Filipinos than to illegal immigrants.
Well, you know, back in the day when I was still in high school, you could go to Subic Bay, and every year they took in about probably 500 Filipinos who were you know, Filipino citizens. They would go in, they would take an exam, and they would accept about 500 who would join the United States Navy, and they would be recruited in batches. They weren't all taken at once. And it would be spread out throughout the Navy in different jobs. No, it's not true. They only went into the kitchens. No, that was a popular choice by Filipinos, but that's not true. The reality is the number of people applying for that could be as high as every year 15,000 Filipinos would be lined up to take that job, because a Navy job back in the 70s and 80s, that was good pay for the Philippines, you know. But nowadays, as I mentioned a while ago, the basic minimum wage for Manila, and this is the minimum, the bare minimum. This is, you know, the guys cleaning tables, doing very basic things in places, is about $2-3 a day, or about 200 something dollars a month, essentially about 12,000 pesos a month. Whereas now, you know, their income as a, let's say, a private is about, take home pay will be about 700, 800 a month. So, you know, it's still a lot higher to join the U.S. military, and I'm sure a lot of Filipinos would like to, but this is one area that I guess we need to talk to our elected officials about and see, you know, why not open up the recruitment again for Filipinos to be able to join. I think that would be a big topic, and also a good way to integrate Filipinos and Americans again. One of the other problems also they're having, which, you know, as we wrap up, I'd like to talk about, is I've shared an article by Manny Magato, who writes for, he's Filipino-Japanese, and he writes for the Reuters news agency. And Manny was sharing this article, which was generally talking about how there is so much pro-China media content that's coming out and being flooded into, like, local newspapers, local TV, local radio. The Chinese are just spending as much as they can for hearts and minds. So you don't see a big rush of people. In fact, very few people, you know, jumping on a boat or a plane and trying to get into China and work in China as a nurse or a doctor or whatever among Filipinos. You see that coming over here. You don't see that going over there. So as far as the wallet goes, as far as the heart goes, as far as the moral fiber goes, it's still very close ties to here. But it is shifting. In fact, it is shifting so much that the last ASEAN summit, the ASEAN is the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and I'll leave you with this question in particular about that. The last summit saw that 52% of people in ASEAN have more trust in commitments for economic issues, not security, but economic, not social justice, but economic, not human rights, but economic. When it comes to the economy, between 62 to 52% of people living in ASEAN prefer China to the United States. Why do you think that? Is there inconsistencies in our policies here in the United States, you think?
Yeah, I would think so. I think, you know, the Chinese have done incredibly well with, you know, lending money and working on infrastructure in the various, you know, in multiple countries. Whereas, you know, when the United States offers assistance, they just offer money without really, you know, improving on infrastructure or things like that. So I think, you know, there is, you know, there would be, you know, an attitude that because of China's, you know, improving infrastructure, you know, whether you pay for it or not, because if you don't pay for it, China takes it over, like what's going on in Africa and so forth. But I would say that, you know, some of those kinds of ASEAN countries would be favorable to that just because they're seeing, you know, they're seeing improvement. They're, you know, whether they know what, you know, how it's being financed and so forth, you know, that's, you know, that's here or there, but it's just perception and how they're viewing, you know, and seeing with their eyes the improvements. I believe that 100%.
Yeah, the perception also, sadly, among Americans is that, you know, most of our trade still is with Europe. It's not. You know, 60%, 67%, I think, of our trade around the world, what we export, what still the United States produces and exports, goes to Asia. You know, that is in terms of agricultural products, in terms of the items we actually manufacture and still manufacture in the United States. It goes to places in Asia, and it's from Korea to Singapore to throughout the region. So for Southeast Asia, there's about a 600 million people market. Japan, I believe, is in the almost 200 million. A little less than 200 million if you include Korea in the mixed population area. Because Korea and Japan are next to each other. I'm not joining the two countries together. I know there's a lot of issues there if you try and do that, you know. But I'm saying as a market, Korea and Japan and ASEAN, you're looking at about probably 800 million people. And 800 million people who have a far better economy than the average person in China. Because the average income in China is much lower than that of Southeast Asia and Korea and Japan. In fact, Japan is the world's third largest economy. Korea on its own, I believe, is the sixth. And then ASEAN, if you were to put it together, would actually just fall in somewhere right behind Japan. So on that note, what are your outlooks? What do you think to wrap things up? I'm going to give you these, you know, last few minutes. What would you like to talk about? You know, you don't have any plans of running except chasing after Nathan now, right?
Yeah. No, I have no plans on furthering a political career. But I will say that you know, I'm with an organization that will be doing more talking and promoting Filipino American relations, because we do need the American economy does need to strengthen our supply chain issues, and if we could create a situation where the Filipino and American can strengthen the supply chain in the various industries, whether the industry is the semiconductor industry, the computer industry, the technology, the food, and so forth. If we could create and motivate more investments into the Philippines, that will help out, you know, not only the United States of America, Philippines relationship, but if we can fix the supply chain worldwide, I think that's where our main focus will be. So you know, look out for us with that organization, and it's going to be pretty interesting. And I think if we can solve a lot of the supply chain issues and make a big improvement in the Philippine economy, I think worldwide we'll see a lot less dependence on China, and that hopefully will make some of the world a little better, safer, and less expensive place to live.
Edwin, what are your socials? Where can people find you online?
They can find me on Twitter at DetroitECA. They can find me on Facebook. Just search my name. And Twitter, Instagram, you name it, I'm on there. And it's all DetroitECA.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Edwin. It was great to have you on the Mike in New York podcast. Have a great day.
Fun show. See you later, Mike. Have a great one.